I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Is it possible for communities reliant on fossil fuels to help lead the climate transition? Too often, coal and gas communities are written off by environmental campaigners as enemies of climate action. But is that kind of thinking just holding back the kind of change we really need? This Changemaker chat is with Elise Ganley. Australia's had a highly polarised climate debate for many years, stuck between a dependence on coal exports and climate culture wars, the need to decarbonise our economy stalled. In 2019, a new project got started that recognised that climate-affected communities can and should play a leadership role shaping climate transition. Rather than leaving policy reform to political leaders or public servants in Canberra, Real Deal for Australia has built place-based projects to create policy solutions from the ground up. Elise is the national leader of this work and lives in Gladstone in central Queensland. Today, she talks about how the Real Deal has cut through some of the polarisation in the climate debate to build climate policy that seeks to improve issues like housing, healthcare, and livability as it builds a renewable energy economy. And full disclosure, I work with Elise at the Sydney Policy Lab, and I was the instigator of the Real Deal project. So I am a pretty big supporter of Elise and this work. I am utterly delighted to bring this story to you on Changemakers today. So let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers is supported by the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. You can find out more about Changemakers on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. So hello, Elise Ganley, and welcome to Changemakers.
Hi, Amanda. Thank you for having me.
This is quite a weird conversation because we actually work together every day, know each other quite well. But we are going to have a conversation now in public so we can share some of the amazing work that you have been leading around the country, a novel approach to how to deal with climate transition. But before we get to that, I just want you to share with our listeners, what kind of change maker are you? How would you describe the kind of change you seek to make in the world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say I'm a community organizer. So I primarily work with communities within civil society, so different community groups, faith groups, unions, environmentalists, to develop leaders to together win campaigns.
And so some on our who listen to us would know, oh, community organising, I've heard all about it. But is there anything more before we get into the why? You've talked about leadership development and you've talked about this array of organisations. Anything else that you think it's important for people to understand about community organising as a way of being a change maker that's helpful for people?
I think primarily what community organisers are about is building deep relationships with people to enable them to tell stories about what's important to them, what's at the heart of what makes them angry, what they're passionate about, what their interests are, and then being able to imagine what's possible in collaboration, both one-to-one, but also in coalition and collaboration with others who are unusual or different suspects to who they might normally imagine their interests aligning with.
Excellent, excellent. So we are going to get into finding out about why you've become a community organiser, in particular working now on issues of climate and economic transition in Australia, by having you tell some of your stories, right? So
yes.
We're going to go back to the source of the crime and find out, like, go back as far back as useful or relevant for us to understand
Why did you become a community organiser now working in climate? Tell us about where that came from for you.
Yeah, I think a lot of the way I think about change really orientates around place and community. And for me, that's because my community is so important to me. So I was born in Bungala country, Wyala, with the red dust of the steelworks and the ocean of the Spencer Gulf. And when I was 8 years old, I moved to Port Pirie, which is across the other side of the ocean there in South Australia on Nukunu country. And my family have been, you know, settlers for five generations around that area. And my mum and dad and my two younger brothers still live in Port Pirie. And I have a lot of really close friends who are back home and lots of cousins and grandparents, and that really orientates me in terms of how I think about the ways that we can make our communities better is that, you know, how we do that in ways that honours the stories of where we're from.
And how do you think that being from Wyala and Port Pirie shaped you as a young person? Like how did that just orient you as a young person?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think my mum and dad are very good at sport. So my mum is an amazing netballer. My dad was the full forward for the Central Wyala Football Club.
Oh my gosh, it's a match.
Yeah. And, you know, my grandparents too. And unfortunately, their firstborn, me, was born with limited sporting ability. And so whilst I hung out a lot at the, you know, within sporting spaces, I found other homes. And so, you know, Port Pirie Youth Theatre was a space where I was able to build my confidence, and also the local church group that we were a part of called the Young Christian Students Movement, which was led by high school students looking at what was happening around them. So, yeah, I think that I got my first sense of how to make a difference through that YCS group, being a Year 9 student, looking at bullying that was happening, looking at racism and how we could respond as high school students, and practicing that every fortnight. What's happening? What do you think about it? How are you going to act? How does that action go? Doing that from the age of 14 really instills a practice of action reflection that's done in community and with others, and you kind of build from that.
Yeah, okay. So you became, you know, active in social and political life quite young. You know, 14, that's very young. Where did that take you, right? So you became an organizer, but what, you know, you started this group, Young Christian Workers Action Reflection. Tell us about the sort of the reflective journey that saw you start there and eventually move to organizing.
Yeah, I think a pivotal moment for me was when other Young Christian Students Movement students from other places around Australia came to visit my school in Port Pirie. I was in year 10, and they decided they wanted to do a day trip where they wanted to go, you know, down the highway and go to Manbrake Creek with the beautiful kind of nature and rivers and that type of thing. Rivers is a strong word. It's a drought, like a creek. and go in a bus down there. And we did that. And then afterwards we went to Baxter Detention Centre, you know, through Port Augusta to Baxter Detention Centre.
And we probably need to, do you want to explain, for those who are listening internationally, tell people about what Baxter is.
Yeah, Baxter Detention Centre was where they imprisoned people who came by boat as part of sort of John Howard's ongoing policy of offshore detention, where they...
And this is for refugees, right?
Yeah, for refugees.
So it's not criminals. And they're for refugees,
yeah,
right?
refugees and asylum seekers. And in Port Augusta, they were supporting young people who were... just wanted to play soccer when they were in community, and other young people that were in Baxter Detention Centre. And as a you know, 8-year-old around September 11 and Woomera Detention Centre, you know, seeing the protests that happened then, and then sort of continuation of that policy in Port Augusta. For me to be in the place that I love and that I call home, surrounded by such a supportive community, and then to have these other students come to Baxter and we prayed together and we sang a song, and they just cried and I didn't. And that stuck with me about how that policy could happen where I lived in a place with people who are compassionate and often, you know, good. How could we have Baxter Detention Centre there? And I think that question stuck with me when I went on to work for the Young Christian Students Movement when I finished school and was trying to figure out how do we stop that kind of horrific injustice happening in Australia and what would that take?
And you talked earlier about place, this deepening understanding of place connecting to your understanding of making a difference, really sort of pushing against each other as you're becoming an adult. So then how did that then... So you're sort of exposed to this activism, this challenging activism in your space, people coming in to protest something that's happening right near you. Where did that go next?
So when I went to work for the Young Christian Students Movement, we had a whole heap of... This policy was continuing, right? So I was then working with high school students who then were saying, hey, this is happening, you know, all around Australia. We need this to stop. And at that time, I was visiting a friend of mine, Kudnush Zad, in Adelaide Inverbrakey Detention Centre, and it was still happening. And I worked with these students to build a coalition to try and get kids out of detention. And it wasn't until I met you, Amanda, and you said, that's great, Elise, but you don't have enough power. Wow. Power. Like, what is that? How do we get that? How do we build it? How do we wield it? And how do we do that together so that this doesn't ever happen again? That kind of sparked something in me that led me to community organizing as an answer to build power and actually to do that in a way that honors the stories of the people that were in my life and the organizations and institutions that formed them. Because often in campaigning, we see people, you know, through messaging tests, or we see people through a particular issue, but community organizing enables people to bring their full selves and their full stories of their values to it. And that's what I loved, because I felt seen in that place, and that we then were actually hard-headed and serious about actually tackling issues that matter.
Mm. And look, like a good community organizer, you are using some strong language here that I'm sure some people who are listening are going, I don't want to wield power. The baddies wield power.
Yeah.
I am not a power wielder. I'm like a nice person who does nice things. Like, how did you grapple with that? Like, talk us a bit through, because, you know, we know that power is a loaded concept. People think of power as bad. You're talking about power as having the capacity for good. Maybe talk us through how you resolve that.
Well, my understanding of it really comes from the Industrial Areas Foundation, which in Australia is the Sydney Alliance, Hunter Community Alliance, and Queensland Community Alliance, which teaches community leaders that we want to build power with. Yeah, we want to build power that's open and transparent and generative and collaborative, and not a power that's over people, but one that is consenting and one that's able to stand up for what we believe in. Because honestly, business and government have no issues with the word power, and they build it and they wield it. And I would want the people in my life who care about their communities to be just as serious about it when it comes to looking after the people that they're in relationship with. And so, yeah, I'm comfortable with it.
So joining in and becoming comfortable with some of these words, you've talked about the Industrial Areas Foundation. You joined the Queensland Community Alliance.
Tell us
a little bit how that experience of being a community organiser with them shaped and changed you as a person.
Yeah, I think, like, for me, it's really important to learn. And like, having come from a tradition where of mentoring and learning from others, it was really important to me that if I was going to put myself out as somebody who was interested in social change, I better get disciplined and get reflective and be able to do that in a serious way and not lead people into defeat. And so that's why I joined the Queensland Community Alliance. I moved to Brisbane in 2017 after going to the UK and hanging out with the Nottingham Citizens, which is a sister organisation there. And the reason I came to Brisbane to do that is because I really loved some of the stuff they were doing.
Yep. And so what did you learn there? Like, what did you, how did organising, I mean, I love it because you're talking about organising as a practice that grows leaders, and you're also talking about organising as being an organiser grew you. How do you think you changed in your time in working as an organiser?
Well, I won some stuff. I think that I'm grateful to the community sector leaders, community centre managers, union leaders, environmental leaders, different multicultural community leaders that really were able to teach me about their communities. And during that time, you know, we've had a founding with Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk, where we've got some initial commitments from her around work and around care. And then I think what I'm most proudest of when I'm working at Queensland Community Alliance is how we scaled. So the ways in which we were able to work really within a couple of suburbs in Logan, in Mount Gravatt, in Stafford, where we were able to listen to what issues people cared about, win something locally, and then scale it up. And for me, that was around working on social isolation and loneliness, working with a community centre and two churches and a few union leaders to say, hey, people are quite lonely in the suburbs and let's not do a community garden, but let's do something systemic that others can learn from. And we were able to fight for money from the Queensland State Government to get a link worker, which was able to connect socially isolated people from GP clinics into community groups. And that was able to be a cure for social isolation, but also help health impacts and that type of thing. But what I love about it is that it didn't just stay there, because we'd built the relationship with Anastasia Palaszczuk and the Queensland State Government. We were able to scale it up. We're able to say, hey, it's not enough for one link worker in Mount Gravatt. What we need is a parliamentary inquiry into social isolation. We got commitments from both sides of the fence for that. And then we were able to get a 10-year strategy around social isolation and a whole heap of funding towards that. So I love the idea of being able to really experiment with change in a place and then being able to learn that and grow that elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're doing all this work, but you've ended up working on the issue of climate transition, you know, the change, particularly in communities that are affected either by fossil fuels or disaster or the possibility of renewals. How did you take that shift, for the shift from being an organiser on any issue to looking particularly at this challenge that is posed by climate in place?
Yeah, it's a good question. And like any good story, sort of a long and unwieldy one. But for me, sort of as COVID was hitting, I had a person add me on Facebook. His name was Hakim. And as we were going into lockdown, he started messaging me to say, hey, my name's Hakim. I'm in Kangaroo Point. I'm in a hotel. We can't leave. Can you help? And that was happening at the same time that we were all locking down. And so I built this friendship with Hakim, who was a refugee who had been in Manus Island for 7 years and had just been brought over under Medivac legislation. And he was being imprisoned in a hotel 10 minutes from where I lived in the middle of Brisbane. And he had built a lot of relationships. It wasn't just me. He built a lot of relationships, and a lot of his other friends that were in there built other relationships, and they started protesting their detention and saying, hey, we know that you're all locking down, but we can't socially distance. We're stuck in here. And it's their protest on the balconies and me and my friends and other members of Queensland Community Alliance responding to that protest movement with our own protests. That was a shift for me, because I felt a strong sense that we needed to have a strong response, and that what was happening in Kangaroo Point could not stand and would not stand, and we needed to act around it. And so that started a blockade, where we blockaded the hotel and we stopped immigration from being able to transport refugees elsewhere out to Bida, which was a detention centre, which was out further the airport where people couldn't see, and where we were able to protest on what was a main road connecting the city. And seeing the inhumanity of the system that was imprisoning Hakim and Farhad and Fazl and Ibrahim, you know, all of our friends, the system that was holding them there, we had to resist that. And the impact of that system was so catastrophic that it led me to questions about what could be possible actually in a climate impacted future, that the authoritarian nature of what we're possible in this country scared me in terms of a climate impact. So yeah, I think that was a real turning point for me. And it led me, I mean, after that blockade and after our friends were freed, you know, they got out and we celebrated and, you know, worked together to make sure that they had housing with local housing organisations and just local people that just stepped up. I then was sort of, my mind was then questioned into, you know, what's next and how do we build something that's hopeful and inclusive and able to actually get on the front foot of climate when actually, to be honest, a lot of the losing that I'd been seeing in the climate movement was actually reminiscent of the refugee movement too, and the stakes are pretty high.
Yeah, and it's stunning that you have lived close to a detention centre twice, you know, once in your teenage years living close to Baxter, and then again, like, and I guess what I'm seeing in your journey is that what happened to refugees in Australia was not just what happened to refugees in Australia, which is horrific, but it's also symbolic of what happens to political life in a crisis, and we've got lots of crisis in this country. So why climate? You know, there's lots of, you know, you could have got busy on refugee work. Like, why do you think that, you know, you then chose to work on this question of transition? What made you choose that as your next journey?
Well, another part of my story is that there was a closure of the Port Augusta coal-fired power station that happened. And in Queensland particularly, the conversation around transition was really lacking in examples. And Port Augusta was often rolled out as, oh, well, this was something that closed. And obviously South Australia has done a, you know, is miles ahead of other states in terms of what's happened in the grid there. But I felt that our communities weren't being seen or recognised in the debate around climate or in the conversation around climate, and that ultimately what needed to happen was that we needed people who were on the ground, who actually impacted by the communities, to have a better say and have a voice. And so, yeah, I started doing a real deal for Australia in that sense, and I guess intentionally chose a place response to that because I think that there's a lot of amazing mobilizers out there who are able to, you know, garner lots of people, you know, in cities. But what was missing from the arena was the hard conversations in communities, you know, such as Gladstone, where I live now, about where people, you know, who are able to really come together and imagine a different way forward. And if that does not happen, and we can't afford that not to happen, right? So we need it in order to avert a whole heap of different crises that the Earth is looking at.
Yeah. So we've got to the sort of discussion really about the how, which is the heart of the Real Deal for Australia project. For the people who haven't heard of it, because it can be a little bit of a tortoise battling out in the cities and regions of Australia, but not necessarily everyone knows. How would you describe what the Real Deal is?
Yeah, we're about building power from the ground up, where people are able to have a say and be at the table around decisions that matter most to them, with a particular lens around climate.
So, and you've talked about it being in particular places, but let's get into that a little bit more. Like, how are you, how's the project rolling out that vision? Like, where is it and how is it doing it in places around the country?
We've built two new coalitions. Which isn't
not
bad
just
in 2 years.
One people, two.
Yeah. So the first place is where I live now. So I live in Gladstone on Bailey, Tarabalung, Bunda, Garang and Garang country in central Queensland. So last week we just launched the outcome of 316 conversations we've had with communities across Gladstone around what pressures people are facing, what we love about the town, and also what our reactions are to transition and the future. So we started, we did that last week. And then in Geelong, there's the context of the collapse of the car industry there. And so people there have lived transition. You know, one of the guys in Geelong, Tony, he says that for him, a successful transition was that no one died in the factory floor where he worked. So we work in Geelong as well, because the people who've been through transition will know what's best around what the future looks like. So sort of been intensely building coalitions in both of those places between community groups, union groups, faith groups, and bringing them together to make sure they have a voice, but then also looking at working with Sydney Alliance in Western Sydney as well, building on and supporting the work that's been done already with migrant communities with Voices for Power.
And I know that there's been a lot of work with First Nations communities in all of those places, and that the Real Deal talks about privileging First Nations voices in the work. How has that been? It's never an easy piece of work, because there's people have got a lot of stuff on already, but like tell us a little bit about that piece of work.
Yeah, so Katie Moore, which Amanda and I both have the pleasure of working with, it's a Wiradjuri woman who has really fed in around this idea of privileging First Nations voices, building on a lot of the works of Christine Evans in Sydney Uni here, where we both work. And I think it's about making sure that is privilege within the process, that relationships are built and solidarity is built in the way that we actually develop policy and wield power together. And that's really been something we've been taking into account sort of throughout the process, understanding that nations have their own process around nation building that they're going through, and trying to embed that as much as possible where we can.
Yeah. And so, I mean, one of the things about the Real Deal Project is it takes the practices of community organising and applies them to the context of places in transition because of climate. Tell us, like, we're going to do it, like, what is good and what is challenging? Firstly, to the question of what is good, you know, thinking about what is so powerful and poignant about organising that makes it well suited to this work?
So in Gladstone, there is going to be rapid economic transition as we transition away from fossil fuels internationally, and you know, need a heap of renewable energy to power the smelters locally there, right? And so that's happening. But what organising enables is for community leaders to actually identify, hey, there's a real problem with the hospital at the moment. You know, in Gladstone, that for months, I think over 6 months, the maternity ward was closed and on bypass, where you couldn't have a baby in a region of 60,000 people. And not only that, there's only one evidence-based supported playgroup in town supporting a region of that many people, when you're going to need a workforce of thousands coming in, constructing, you know, new industries and welcoming new migrants and that type of thing. That there's no organizing enables the conversation to start where people are at and what they're currently experiencing, to be able to name that, negotiate around that, and then also recognize the complexity of the future as well. But ultimately, it enables you to see people.
Yeah, and I imagine in every place, and we know that people are going to be affected differently by climate change depending on where you work, how you work, your skills, and so forth. I guess the relational approach, that the idea of relationships preceding action, spending the time, like, you know, people think climate change and they freak out and they want change tomorrow, but actually there is an argument for the relationship-based approach coming first that has merit in these contexts where things are actually the hardest.
Exactly. And, you know, in Gladstone, when we did this process, a lot of people spoke about when the gas terminals were built and the impact that had on the community and the scars that people very tangibly feel today with living of the impacts of that. And it enables those stories to come through. Similarly, you know, in Geelong, with the impacts of Ford factory's departures, it enables them to say, you know, this happened and it was tough and we did this amazing thing, but also this was really hard. And I don't think that mobilising as an approach enables that kind of nuance or complexity. And I think that that's why this is a good tool to be using in the wider context of climate action.
Yeah, because sometimes climate debate is polarised, and at some point there's going to be always in public policy a for and against, but actually what you're describing is that polarised too soon and people who who actually have something to say and an interest in supporting a transition, they'll fall against it if they feel like they're not heard. Like, people might be wary about transition because they were left out of the transition last time. That doesn't mean that they're not for or against. It's not actually about climate change. It's actually about whether people are going to respect them and respond to them. And if a process doesn't build those relationships and allow people to express where their perspective comes from, rather than just a poll that says, are you for this or are you against this? Like, a more detailed and holistic response, seeing people as whole people with lots of experiences, is actually going to be so powerful in places that are going to be particularly affected where the crunch is on.
Right, and I think where we're moving is, like, we know that we need to build heaps of things. We need transmission lines. We need, you know, solar farms, wind farms. We need clean exports. There's a whole heap of stuff and ways that our communities will be changing in the next decade. And that's a shift for the environmental movement to grapple with in terms of, you know, what minerals are mined and how we work with communities. That means that we need community centres able to say what's important to them. You know, we need to have spaces where people can really name their interests, because if we don't do that, it's going to be harder to build what we need for the transition, and also will mean that, you know, we get deeper polarisation. So I think that the more that we can use that in places to ensure community benefits is going to be really key.
Excellent. So one of the things that I think is interesting, and I have to admit, people, I am biased. I'm a very big fan and deeply involved in the Real Deal for Australia project. But one of the things that's been interesting about the project is not just that we've sought to apply organising, but that we have experimented with a traditional understanding of community organising. Do you want to talk us through some of the things that have been different about Real Deal compared to a traditional community organising approach?
I think what's different is the scale of the challenge, and therefore the need to be organising and bringing in different ideas to deal with the immediate problems that we're facing. So a traditional community organising, broad-based community organising approach is being able to identify a neighbourhood, key institutions within that, run a listening campaign. What are people facing? How do we fix it? Action, win, evaluate, right? That's the classic thing. But in the context of the changes that are happening in climate over the next decade, we also need to be engaging and interacting with the ways that policy is forming and the ways that we're thinking about policy and how it impacts communities. So I think the way that we are intentionally trying to organise ideas and contribute to the development of thinking around community benefits and when infrastructure is being built in communities, I think that connection with, you know, really quite accomplished researchers to aid and be in relationship with the communities that we're working with is probably what makes this different.
Mm. And so just so people understand, like, and this is like the double act that Elise and I do in our job. So at the Sydney Policy Lab and through the University of Sydney, we've built a national network of researchers that partner with the organisers to bring that sort of research expertise to some of these technically difficult questions and sort of draw strengths together to come up with the best policy we can.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's a real strength to the work. And I think that we're all learning about how to do those processes together, aren't we, Amanda?
Oh, we are. There's just, you can't be Pollyanna about that relationship either. You know, like research and universities move at a slower pace than even community organisers, who move at a slower pace than your usual social change person. And so there is a different negotiation, a different set of priorities that, I would say we're still early stage learning. But I think it's one of those things that we need to get right if we're going to be able to harness, all the brain power that we have to be able to, and all the experiential power that we have to be able to craft the best policies going forward.
Yeah, definitely. And we have a lot of fun doing that.
Oh, we do have a lot of fun. So I'm wondering, you're in this space. You've moved cities. You're living in Gladstone. You've thrown yourself into it. Like, what is your hope that the Real Deal can have on Australia's climate debate, on global climate practice, on how we move our way through these questions of transition? Like, what do you think it's possible to deliver using these tools, having this contribution?
That's a big question.
Yeah. Just in a couple of minutes, if you could.
So my hope really is that as we transition away from fossil fuels, that it's an opportunity to make people's lives better. It's an opportunity to do community better, to strengthen our community's capacity to respond, and that we, as we are, you know, going to see the impacts of climate changes in disasters, that we are able to build a community that's more connected to each other, that's able to speak and is able to act, and I guess at the same time enable an economy that really works for people. And we have to do that with you know what we know is to come. So I hope that the piece that we're doing at The Real Deal in communities across Australia is a contribution to that, and that we don't just see wins or changes both in those communities, but we're able to work with others to see the big changes that we need in Australia, and, you know, doing that in partnership, you know, and justice with First Nations people.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the thing of seeing climate not just as a climate challenge but a democracy challenge, and the hope being that this can be a moment for rebuilding our democracy as well as dealing with the changes to our climate.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. So here's my last question, right? So you've done this, you've had this extraordinary period of work ranging all across different forms of community organising in particular, and you've worked on the Real Deal project around climate transition for several years. How do you think it's changed you? Reflecting on all of the stories that you shared from, you know, you being young and in the red dust of regional South Australia, how do you think that this work on the Real Deal has changed you?
Yeah, it's a really big question. I think we have to believe in people. And, you know, moving to Gladstone 9 months ago was pretty scary. But being able to get to know people and to be welcomed by people, I think gives me hope. And I think that we have to hold on to that hope, not just as a feeling, but as an action. Yeah, like we build more hope through action. And I think that it's the daily showing up with community to reimagine how things could be different that stays with me and isn't a grand reveal really from when I was 14. It's the same practice that I do, you know, even from then. And I hope to keep that optimism, you know, for the next 15 years, 30 years, or, you know, lifelong community organizer, I hope.
Yeah. Well, we're going to need the hopers are doing to make this world better. And at least the work that you're doing is a spectacular model for that. Thank you so much for coming on Changemakers and sharing about the Real Deal project. And we'll provide some more information about this in the show notes for people who are interested. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. And this is Series 7, so there's plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. Our digital producer at Changemakers is Lachlan Hodson. Our audio producer is Jules Walker. Our series sponsor is the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. On that website, you can also find out more about the Real Deal project. So that's sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Like us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads at Changemakers Podcast. We're on Twitter still at Changemakers99, and I'm on Twitter still at Amanda Tats. And you can also check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on our stories. And don't forget to take a look at our organising school content if you want to take a deeper dive into the art of changemaking.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.